Katra Podcast Conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome, curious minds. Today we're diving into a deep dive that really challenges, the way most of us think about success. We're talking about Malcolm Gladwell's major work, Outliers, The Story of Success. And our mission here is to look beyond that classic image of the lone genius as a totally self-made person, right? Instead, we want to explore the hidden things, the systems, the luck, the cultural background that actually paved the way for extraordinary achievement.
Exactly. Think of this as a kind of shortcut to understanding what Gladwell calls the hidden architecture of success. We're moving past the whole great man idea and asking, okay, what environment, what specific context, what perfect historical timing had to line up for this person to become, well, an outlier. And Gladwell kicks things off with this fantastic metaphor, really foundational, the Roseto mystery. It's about this small town in Pennsylvania, mostly Italian immigrants back then. In the 1960s, they had stunningly low rates of heart disease. I mean, way lower than the rest of the U.S., even lower than Italy itself.
Right. And the weird thing was, researchers couldn't figure it out. It wasn't diet, wasn't exercise, wasn't genes, wasn't even the region. The only real difference, their community, how supportive and tightly knit it was.
They realized, to understand why individuals were so healthy, they had to look at the community itself. And that's the big lesson for outliers. If you want to understand the successful individual, you absolutely have to look at the world that shaped them.
That just immediately flips the script, doesn't it? On all those stories we love about rugged individualism, if the community matters that much, does that mean talent or drive? Are they almost secondary? That's something we'll definitely unpack.
And the person making this argument, Malcolm Gladwell, he's kind of uniquely positioned. He was raised in rural Canada. His mother was Jamaican, his father British. So he brings this this valuable outsider's perspective to the often very rigid American ideas about meritocracy.
Yeah, and what makes his viewpoint so impactful is his long career as a staff writer for The New Yorker since 96. He's not primarily an academic researcher himself, but he's a master synthesizer, a storyteller. He takes these complex ideas from sociology, psychology, economics,
and makes them unforgettable. He finds these counterintuitive truths and presents them through stories. He spots the human pattern hiding in the data, makes these really dense concepts totally accessible.
He shows you, the listener, the patterns you might have missed. And with Outliers, he turns that lens onto success itself, basically saying, look, if you want to know how some people reach the absolute top, you need to understand the rules of the game they were playing, often without even realizing it.
Okay, so let's dig into the core thesis. The central argument is pretty stark, actually. Extraordinary success isn't mainly about innate talent or just sheer willpower. It's more often the result of a specific, sometimes random, combination of advantages. Perfect timing, cultural legacies, opportunities that just build on each other.
Right. And the book's laid out in two main parts. There's opportunity, which covers external stuff like, when you're born, timing, getting to practice. And then there's legacy, which is more about cultural inheritance, family background, that kind of thing.
And when you put those two together, you start to see that success often seems less about who you are and much more about when and where you happen to be.
It really challenges that whole idea that the smartest, hardest working person always wins. Gladwell shows, look, effort is essential, of course, but opportunity. That's the prerequisite. It's not really a how-to guide, is it? It's more like a systems analysis for anyone who's ever wondered why success seems to clump together sometimes.
Absolutely. It's a look under the hood.
Okay, let's get into the evidence then, starting with maybe one of the most striking examples of how something totally arbitrary, like a cutoff date, can shape destiny. It's called the Mathieu effect, the idea of cumulative advantage. So take elite Canadian hockey players. There's this really bizarre pattern. A huge number of the top players are born in January, February, or March, right at the beginning of the year. Now, are babies born in January just naturally better athletes?
Well, no, of course not. It turns out the cutoff date for youth hockey leagues in Canada is January 1st. So a kid born on January 2nd is playing against kids who might have been born in late December of the same year.
Ah, so they're almost a full year older.
Exactly. And when you're 7 or 8 years old, that physical maturity difference, it's huge. So the slightly older, bigger kids get picked out early. They seem more talented.
And that's the crucial part, isn't it? Because they get labeled talented early on. They get the better coaches, more ice time, more games, more practice. And that small, totally arbitrary age advantage just snowballs. Over years, it becomes this massive real difference in skill purely because of accumulated resources and opportunities.
Mm-hmm. The initial difference was just age. The final difference is skill built on opportunity.
Wow.
And this leads us right into maybe the most famous and probably most misinterpreted idea from the book, the 10,000-hour rule. Gladwell, drawing on research by Anders Ericsson, argues that mastery in almost any complex field requires about 10,000 hours of deliberate practice.
Right. Everyone talks about the number, 10,000 hours.
Yeah, but the real insight from Gladwell isn't just the number itself. It's the fact that having the opportunity to actually put in those 10,000 hours, that's the hidden advantage. Very few people get that chance.
Okay, so give us an example. Like, the Beatles.
Perfect example. They weren't just naturally gifted musicians who burst onto the scene. Yeah. Before they hit it big, they spent years playing in Hamburg, Germany. Grueling gigs. 8 hours a night, 7 nights a week sometimes.
Wow, 8 hours.
Yeah, they logged way more than 10,000 hours of intense performance practice in those clubs. That specific kind of rough opportunity forced them to get incredibly tight as a band. It was their 10,000 hours.
And Bill Gates? Same idea.
Same idea, different field. Obviously brilliant, but his timing was impeccable. As a teenager in Seattle, he got access to a high-end, real-time computer terminal at the University of Washington way back in 1968.
That's honorably early.
Almost unheard of globally. That unique access allowed him to rack up thousands and thousands of hours of programming practice long before personal computers were even a thing for most people. The talent was there, sure, but the sheer timed practice provided by that specific opportunity, that was the gift.
Okay, so opportunity for practice is key. But here's where it gets maybe even more counterintuitive for me. The limits of just raw intelligence. Gladwell does this fascinating comparison between two certified geniuses. Christopher Langen, who has this astronomical IQ, supposedly higher than Einstein's, but he ended up working mostly manual labor jobs, struggling with institutions. And then you have J. Robert Oppenheimer, leader of the Manhattan Project. Also brilliant, obviously, but incredibly successful within the system.
Right. And the difference, Gladwell argues, isn't the IQ points, especially once you get above a certain threshold, maybe around 120 or so. Beyond that, what seems to matter much more for worldly success is something he calls practical intelligence.
Practical intelligence. What exactly is that?
It's basically social savvy. It's knowing how to navigate situations, how to persuade people, how to read a room, how to advocate for yourself, how to get what you need from institutions. It's street smarts, almost, but applied to systems.
And Langen, coming from a background of real poverty and instability, apparently lacked that. He didn't know how to talk his way through problems with university administrators, for example.
Exactly. Whereas Oppenheimer came from an affluent background. And Gladwell connects this to the work of sociologist Annette Leroux, who talks about concerted cultivation. It's how upper-middle-class parents tend to actively teach their kids how to interact with authority figures, how to negotiate, how to question things. It's a learned skill set.
So practical intelligence isn't innate. It's something you learn. Often based on your upbringing.
That seems to be the argument. It's a strategy for making the system work for you.
Okay, so we've got cumulative advantage, the need for opportunity to practice, and the importance of practical intelligence over just IQ.
And connecting all this is the huge role of sheer demographic luck and timing. You need the skills, sure, but you also need to be in the right place at the right time and know how to seize that moment. The lawyer, Joe Flom, is a great case study here.
Ah, yes, the legendary takeover lawyer.
Right. His incredible success was built, ironically, on things that initially looked like disadvantages. First off, he was born around 1930. That was during the Great Depression, a time of very low birth rates.
Meaning less competition.
Less competition throughout his entire life, for spots in good schools, for jobs, everything. Second, he was Jewish. In the mid-20th century, that meant the big, prestigious white shoe law firms on Wall Street wouldn't hire him.
So he was excluded.
He was excluded from the established corporate law work. So his small firm had to take the work nobody else wanted, things like litigation and crucially hostile corporate takeovers, which at the time were seen as sort of de classe. But then in the 70s and 80s, hostile takeovers exploded. They became huge business. And suddenly Joe Flom and his firm were the ones with decades of experience in exactly that field. What started as an exclusion became a massive advantage because the whole market shifted right towards his niche expertise.
Wow. So being forced outside the mainstream put him in the perfect position later on. Plus, Gladwell mentions his parents were garment workers, right? Instilling a kind of complex work ethic early on.
Mm-hmm. Three key advantages, none of which he really earned in the traditional sense. Demographic luck, being an outsider at the right time, and a useful cultural background. It all lined up.
Okay, let's shift from timing and opportunity to culture itself, because Gladwell makes this powerful case that deep-seated cultural legacies don't just affect business. They can have life or death consequences. The example of the Korean air crashes in the 1990s is just staggering.
It really is. And the crucial point here is that the problem wasn't the pilot's technical skill. Korean pilots were well-trained. The issue was rooted in their culture's High Power Distance Index, or PDI, a concept from the sociologist Geert Hofstede.
Power Distance Index. What does that mean exactly?
It measures how much a culture accepts and expects inequality and hierarchy. Korea has a very high PDI, meaning there's immense respect for authority figures. In the cockpit, the captain is the ultimate authority.
Okay, so how did that lead to crashes?
It meant that first officers and flight engineers, even when they suspected or knew the captain was making a serious error, often couldn't challenge him directly. They'd use what Gladwell calls mitigated speech.
Mitigated speech?
Like hints. Exactly. Very indirect, polite, deferential ways of pointing out a problem. Instead of saying, "Captain, we're flying too low," they might say something like, "Captain, are you concerned about the weather?" Basically, they were too culturally conditioned to be deferential, to state the danger clearly and assertively.
That's terrifying. Communication breakdown rooted in cultural norms.
Mm-hmm. But here's the hopeful part. Cultural patterns aren't destiny. Korean Air completely turned around its safety record. How? By fundamentally changing its cockpit culture.
What did they do?
They implemented new communication protocols. They trained their crews to communicate much more directly, flattening the hierarchy in emergencies. They even encouraged, or sometimes required, pilots to communicate in English during critical phases of flight.
Why English?
Because English, for them, didn't carry the same deep cultural baggage of deference as Korean. Switching languages helped break the old communication patterns. It shows that culture is powerful, but it can be consciously reshaped.
Okay, that's a lot of powerful examples. If we try to pull out the main themes running through all of this,
yeah,
what would they be?
Well, I think theme number one has to be the cumulative nature of advantage. Those small, often random initial edges, being born in January for hockey, getting early access to a computer, even being excluded from the right firms, they don't just add up, they compound. Success isn't usually one big break. It's the snowball effect of many smaller ones.
Right. It's less about a single moment of brilliance and more about the accumulation over time. Okay, what's theme two?
Theme two is definitely the enduring influence of cultural legacy. Our background, where our families came from, the kind of work they did, the social norms we inherited, deeply shapes our attitudes towards work, towards authority, towards persistence. Gladwell talks about the culture of honor in Appalachia, or the legacy of hard, meticulous work from Asian rice paddy farming. These patterns stick around for generations and really influence how we navigate the world and its challenges.
Okay, cumulative advantage, cultural legacy. What's the third big one?
I think the third is really the overarching message, the limits of individual merit. Gladwell is essentially arguing that success is often a gift of history, a gift of community, a gift of circumstance. Yes, individual effort, talent, drive, they're absolutely necessary, but they aren't sufficient. They always operate within the context of the opportunities and constraints provided by our environment and our culture.
It really reframes success as something more ecological, maybe. Less about the lone wolf.
Exactly. It's a product of an ecosystem.
And the book is just packed with these lines that really make you stop and think, summarizing these big ideas.
Oh, definitely. My absolute favorite, the one that sums up the whole book for me, is the outlier in the end is not an outlier at all.
Hmm. That's powerful.
It's the mic drop, right? It means that what looks like this unique, inexplicable, almost magical achievement from the outside, once you understand the underlying system, the advantages, the timing, the culture, it actually becomes, well, predictable.
Yeah.
Success follows patterns if you know where to look.
It demystifies it in a way. And the other one that really changed the conversation around talent is practice isn't the thing you do once you're good. It's the thing you do that makes you good.
Yes. That shifts the focus completely. Away from some kind of innate magical talent you're just born with and onto the process. The sustained, deliberate effort over thousands of hours, it puts the power back into the work itself.
So thinking about all this, how does it apply to us, practically? Let's talk about education first.
Yeah.
Gladwell discusses the KIPP schools, the Knowledge is Power program.
Right, and their success, especially with students from low-income backgrounds, is really instructive. Gladwell argues it demonstrates that the so-called achievement gap between rich and poor kids isn't primarily about ability, it's an opportunity gap. Well, research shows that kids from all socioeconomic backgrounds tend to learn at roughly the same rate during the school year. The gap widens dramatically over the summer.
The summer slide.
Exactly. Affluent kids often keep learning through camps, travel, reading, museums. Many lower-income kids not only don't have those opportunities, but they can actually lose ground, the summer learning loss. It's another form of cumulative disadvantage.
So what do KPP schools do differently?
They basically eliminate the long summer break. They have longer school days, Saturday classes, summer sessions. They simply give their students more time on task, more opportunity for that deliberate practice, leveling the playing field. The solution isn't magic. It's engineering more opportunity.
That makes so much sense. It's about providing the hours.
Yeah.
What about for us as individuals? Any takeaways for personal development?
I think so. The message isn't deterministic, like, oh, well, I wasn't born at the right time. Instead, it suggests that rather than just waiting for talent to show up, we should be actively looking for or even creating opportunities for that focused, deliberate practice in whatever field matters to us.
Be proactive about finding your hamburger.
Kind of. And also consciously trying to cultivate that practical intelligence, you know, working on communication skills, learning how to navigate social situations effectively, how to advocate for yourself or your ideas. Those skills can be learned, and they clearly make a big difference, according to Gladwell.
Okay, reflecting on the whole book, what was the biggest surprise for you? What really stuck with you?
For me, it was just how much timing mattered. You mentioned the software billionaires born in that narrow mid-1950s window. It wasn't just that they were smart. It was that they came of age precisely when the personal computer revolution was dawning. They were perfectly positioned historically. That power of pure dumb luck timing, that was eye-opening.
Yeah, me too. That historical positioning idea really hit home. It wasn't just Bill Gates. It was Paul Allen, Steve Jobs, Bill Joy, Eric Schmidt, all born within a few years. It really drives home the right place, right time factor.
And I think what I ultimately learned, or what was reinforced, is the idea that if we understand these patterns, these systems that create success, we can actually use that knowledge to build better, more equitable systems ourselves. We can stop just admiring the outliers and start thinking about how to engineer more opportunities for everyone.
Right. The factors aren't some deep mystery. They're identifiable. They can potentially be replicated or compensated for.
Exactly. It gives us agency, in a way.
So here's a final thought for you, our listeners, to mull over. If success really is more about systematic opportunity and historical context than purely individual genius, as Gladwell argues, what's one concrete change we should be pushing for in our schools or maybe your workplaces right now to give more people a fair shot at logging their 10,000 hours and developing their potential? See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.